On a cold winter's day in December 1914, the men of both sides emerged from their trenches, not to fight a battle, not to attack, but to take part in the Christmas truce. For a brief while, there was peace in no man's land. As the Great War centenary approached, people began to think about what might be the most contentious issues to be discussed over those 4 years of 2014 to 2018. Would it be the generals, the high command? Would it be strategy and tactics, the deployment of technology on the battlefield? No, it was not going to be any of those things. It was going to be football and a single day in December 1914, the Christmas truce. So while sure there were discussions about French and Haig, who commanded the British Expeditionary Force on the Western Front, and while there were debates about the use of tactics on the battlefields from the early attacks at Neuve Chapelle to the first day on the Battle of the Somme and the Black Day of the German Army in 1918, the reality was that one thing that in the popular media people focused on was the idea that a football match took place across vast swathes of northern France and Flanders on Christmas Day 1914. Now, it's a great story, but what's the truth behind it? What happened at Christmas 1914? Where was the British Army at that time? Was there really football? And what was the significance of the Christmas truce? That's what we'll look at in this episode of The Old Front Line. So first of all, where was the British Army and what was it doing? Well, the British Army had been at war since the 4th of August 1914, when Britain had declared war on Germany, and the first troops had arrived in France the very next day to set up the infrastructure at places like Le Havre and Rouen for the Expeditionary Force, the British Expeditionary Force, or BEF, to come over to fight whatever battles lay ahead. And those battles had taken it to Mons in August, on the Marne and the Aisne in September, and then in northern France from Le Bassée to Armentières and up into Flanders around the Belgian city of Ypres in October and November of 1914 with the battles of Le Bassée and the first battle of Ypres. During that time, the 370,000 odd men of the British Expeditionary Force, comprised mainly of regular soldiers but latterly supported by territorials that arrived at the fronts from as early as September of 1914, had suffered substantial casualties, but reservists and replacements, as the autumn moved into the winter of 1914, began to arrive, but the army was not going to be fighting any battles for the foreseeable future, at least not this side of the new year. So it began to dig in, and the Germans were digging in opposite, and that's when the whole Western Front began to be created, running from the Belgian coast right down through Belgium, northern France, eastern France, and ending on the border of Switzerland. 450 miles of continuous trenches. Not one trench, but a system of different trenches, effectively interconnected, running across that huge sway of Belgium and France. As this front stabilised, the British Army, the British Expeditionary Force, took over a defined section of the Western Front. Its northern boundary was close to the city of Ypres, at the village of Saint-Éloi, and north of that were the French. Ypres, at that time in 1914 on into early 1915, was effectively part of the French front in Belgium. So our lines went from the village of Saint-Éloi, down following the Messines Ridge, over across into northern France, around the town of Armentières, home of the famous Mademoiselle from Armentières, and then down across the flatlands of the villages like Bois-Grenier and Neuve Chapelle and Richebourg, down to the Le Bassée Canal, near to the town of Le Bassée. So that front of about 20-odd miles as the crow flies from Saint-Éloi to the Le Bassée Canal was the British sector in December of 1914, with a few detached units here and there, and not all of the British Expeditionary Force in the line. Some units were out on rest. The main town behind the lines at this time was not Poperinge, which we most associate with the British Army in that sector of the Western Front. That was under French occupation at that time for its troops serving in the trenches around Ypres. Our main town was Balliol in northern France, in old French Flanders. And this town that sat at a junction of railway lines close to another main railhead at Hazebrouck was all part of our infrastructure that we were building up during that autumn into winter of 1914 to supply our troops on the front line from Ypres down to La Bassée, and then utilise the many villages around Balliol as rest areas for the troops. At this time, there were no camps for soldiers to go to when they were out on rest. They were billeted with the civilian population in these areas. And at this stage of the war, the civilian population were very accommodating with the arrival of all these British troops. As the war went on and everyone became war weary, I suspect, they perhaps became, understandably, a little bit less accommodating as thousands, hundreds of thousands of British soldiers in size 10 boots tramped all over their property and many occasions caused damage, as the surviving war diaries of town majors in these base areas tell us. But all that was yet to come. As Christmas approached in December 1914, a high proportion of the British Expeditionary Force were in that 20-odd mile front from Saint-Éloi to La Bassée Canal. Units from the 3rd, the 4th, the 6th, 7th and the 8th Divisions, that's roughly from north to south, so the 3rd were in the northern sector around Saint-Éloi, and the 7th and 8th Divisions were between Bois-Grenier and Neuve-Chapelle. There too was the Meerut Division of the Indian Corps and the 1st Division. The 2nd and 5th Divisions were out on rest, although there were some interchange of units as the Christmas period approached. The Commander-in-Chief at this stage of the war was not Douglas Haig, it was Sir John French. Haig was a corps commander, one of several corps now within the British Army, each corps made up of several of these divisions. And the size of the expeditionary force at this stage is difficult to say, but it certainly numbers a good couple of 100,000 men when you take into account all of the men behind the lines feeding the army, supplying the army. So that was units like the Army Service Corps and the Royal Engineers that were behind the front, along with medics and veterinary corps and all the others from places like Balliol right back to the coast and down towards Rouen. And Rouen was the main base depot of the British Army at this time. There had been some action in the lead up to Christmas of 1914, despite the fact that after the First Battle of Ypres and the fighting around La Bassée, both sides had dug in. The British Army had some attempts to try and break that stalemate with some small-scale attacks, none of which were particularly successful. One at Wytschaete, White Sheets, saw British troops attack without artillery support straight into well-entrenched German positions, and the outcome was pretty much guaranteed with heavy losses. That attack was observed from Kemmel Hill by General Plumer, and it is said also the Prince of Wales. At Plug Street, there had been an attack near the Birdcage, one of the German positions just east of the wood, and there had been fighting around Richebourg and Festubert as well. So what that meant was that as the weather turned and it got increasingly cold and there were flurries of snow, both sides preparing for winter quarters as the winter approached, no man's land in front of them was full of dead from these small-scale attacks. And the general conditions in the trenches was pretty poor. Again, this is the early stage of the Great War. The trenches on both sides were nothing like they were later on. They were fairly primitive trenches. On the British side, many soldiers had utilised ditches by the side of the road as part of their trench system. They were dry in the autumn. Now, as the winter approached, they were filling with water. And in places like the trenches around Ypres, down at Plug Street, and even in northern France, Bois-Grenier and Neuve-Chapelle, when the men dug in, increasingly the trenches flooded. And there are many photographs in the collection of the Imperial War Museum, for example, where you can see quite clearly how bad some of these conditions were. And I'll put a couple of pictures that I have from this period on the podcast website, oldfrontline.co.uk, so you can have a look and see the sort of conditions that soldiers were living in. This was an army in 1914, of course, that had gone to war expecting a mobile war, not a static war, and certainly not a static war on this scale. Although only holding 20-odd miles of 450 miles of the Western Front, this was a significant challenge for the British Army at that time. And men had cold weather gear, which was really their greatcoats. Leather jerkins weren't issued at this stage to give the men a little bit of extra warmth. So a lot of soldiers, you see this in the contemporary pictures. And again, I'll put a couple of postcards up on the Old Frontline website so you can see what I'm talking about. But what soldiers did is they got hold of goatskin and sheepskin fleeces and they wore them over their uniforms, giving them a little bit of extra protection from the elements. Now, serving in a frontline trench or sleeping out of the line in billets, you got dirty very, very quickly, and these goatskin and sheepskin jerkins pretty quickly became breeding grounds for lice and were not very comfortable. I remember one veteran that I interviewed who was in the Queen's Westminster Rifles at that time, Aubrey Rose. He said that these things were almost alive themselves, considering the amount of lice that were in them. So while it gave you a bit of protection from the coals, it created its own problems by wearing these things. And you see them disappear gradually as 1915 moves in towards 1916. The greatcoats that soldiers did have did give them some protection against the colds. They were warm, but they were long. And the author Henry Williamson, who we'll come back to later on in this podcast, records in his memoirs and in his writing, extensive writing about the Great War, that the tail of the greatcoat, the ends of it, would trail in the water, and when it got cold, they would freeze solid. So they took their bayonets and their jackknives to the bottom of their greatcoats and hacked them off. And there is a photograph of Williamson serving at this time with the London Rifle Brigade around Plugstert, where you can see quite clearly that he's hacked the bottom of his greatcoat off. So I'm sure that that was not an unusual thing for soldiers to do at this time. What was clear, though, after these attacks had taken place in December, that further fighting this winter was going to be pretty much impossible. The conditions would not allow it. And really, certainly the British Army was not really in a position to do that until it had received more reinforcements, more supplies, and had grown in strength and got more and bigger guns to support it on the battlefield. So effectively, both sides had resigned themselves to settling down to this winter period, where their major task would not be fighting, but it would be labouring, repairing trenches, working on trenches to make them more suitable for men to live in on protracted periods. Because at this stage of the war, certainly in the British Army, units occupied the front line for a much longer period than they would later in the war. As 1914, for example, moved into 1915, the 2nd Battalion Manchester Regiment spent 85 consecutive days in the front line, simply because there were not enough men in the expeditionary force to keep rotating men battalions around. So this was the reality of it. So it meant settling down, as I say, for the winter, and soldiers not fighting, not using their weapons, but using their tools, their picks, their shovels, and anything else that was required to work on the positions in which they lived. Opposite the British at this time were a large number of German army units from Bavaria and Saxony. And Bavaria, being a Catholic region of Germany, had a very strong Christian Christmas tradition. And the Saxons, most closely associated with the history of Britain, and possibly feeling a bit of a kinship to the British, and I'm sure this had a connection to the events that unfolded at Christmas 1914, they too had a strong Christmas tradition. And there were a couple of examples before Christmas Day where the Germans came out into no man's land and requested what we could describe as a truce. Largely, this was prompted by the burial of the dead. We mentioned before how there'd been attacks and there were fallen soldiers in no man's land, and even in the cold, the smell would not have been pleasant. So this prompted the Germans to suggest a period of non-activity, of ceasefire, to allow the burial of the dead. But the real instigator that led to the events on Christmas Day 1914 became apparent, really, to the men in the British trenches in the lead-up to Christmas itself on Christmas Eve, when, according to the accounts, soldiers saw the Germans putting Christmas trees on their parapets and Christmas lanterns, and began singing Christmas carols, many of which, of course, because of the strong connection, the strong history between Britain and Germany in the 19th century, although the words would have been in German, the tunes would have been greatly familiar to the British soldiers in the front line, Silent Night being a good example of that. And even if these stories of Christmas trees and lanterns and carols have been greatly exaggerated, or even partially exaggerated, in the memoirs and the accounts of men who were there, and certainly in recent media, there's no doubt that on Christmas Eve 1914, a British army consisting largely of regular soldiers and reservists or territorials, part-time soldiers, many of them from what you could describe as middle-class battalions, like the Queen's Westminster Rifles and the London Rifle Brigade, for example, these men were no doubt, being human, they were thinking of home and perhaps of Christmases before. Again, Henry Williamson called that last Christmas before 1914, the Christmas of 1913, the last Christmas of the old world. And perhaps they thought back to that and remembered those days. And for most men in the line on Christmas Eve 1914, soldiering was a job. It was their job. They were regular soldiers. And the chance of a day off, if it was offered, might well be taken. And as Christmas Eve drifted into Christmas Day, in many places the white flurry of snow had gathered on the ground, but there was the rumble of guns. This was a different Christmas. They were at war. But what would happen on Christmas Day? Rather than try to look at the whole of that 20-odd mile British front on Christmas Day 1914, we'll focus in one of our walks on one particular area of the front and some aspects of the Christmas truce that took place there. So we're going to start at Prowse Point Cemetery, near to the village, the hamlets of St. Yvonne, just north of Plugstert or Plug Street Wood, on the southern part of the Flanders front. The men who fought in the 1914 campaign were called the Old Contemptibles, and we spoke in one of the earlier episodes of The Old Frontline to Andrew Thornton about his research into the men of the Old Contemptibles Association. And Prowse Point Cemetery, for me, is very much an Old Contemptibles cemetery. It's a cemetery, actually, where when I used to deliver a tour for Ledger Holidays called The Old Contemptibles, we used to end it here, because this is where the men of the 1914 campaign who'd fought that war of movement from Mons in the retreat to the Marne and the Aisne and the First Battle of Ypres and the fighting around La Bassée, this is where for them the war went static and a new war emerged. And the cemetery is full of men who had taken part in that campaign and were killed when the front went static here in October, November and December of 1914. It's named after an officer of the 1st Battalion, the Somerset Light Infantry, who are very heavily involved in the story of what happened here in 1914. And that officer, Prowse, is Charles Bertie Prowse, or Bertie Prowse, as he was known. He was a major, a company commander in 1914, when the battalion, just over 1,000 strong, went to war. And with them, he took part in the Battle of Le Cateau and the retreat from Mons. Prowse then took over command of the battalion on the 12th of September during the fighting on the Aisne, and he commanded them here at Plugstert, Plug Street, into that autumn and winter period of the last part of that year. His command post was very close to where the cemetery is now, and this position on the battlefield, marked on trench maps as Prowse Point, was one of a number of features on the Western Front, farms, command posts, strong points that were named after him and are illustrated on the maps of the period. In April 1915, he took command of the 11th Infantry Brigade, of which the 1st Somersets were a part, so he was promoted from battalion commander to brigade commander and given the rank of brigadier general. And on the first day of the Battle of the Somme, his men went into the attack near the Heidenkopf, the Heathen's Head, a German defensive position near Serre on the Somme, and suffered tremendous losses. All of his battalion commanders became casualties in that action, and he went forward As a brigadier general, his job was behind the lines, but he went forward and entered the battle to try and take command himself and was mortally wounded, dying of wounds at a casualty clearing station at Vauxchelles on the Somme, and he became the most senior British officer to die on the first day of the Battle of the Somme. Again, another one of these men that disproves this idea of chateau generals. And his battalion that was here, the 1st Somersets, had gone to war, as I mentioned before, with just over 1,000 officers and men in August 1914. And by Christmas of 1914 of the same year, about 200 of them remained serving with the battalion. Now, that didn't mean that 800 had been killed. That meant that 800 officers and men had become casualties in one way or another. Wounded, prisoners of war, killed in action, missing, and men who'd gone sick. And as the autumn moved into the winter here, more and more men went sick rather than became casualties from enemy action. Now, when we come out of the cemetery via the cemetery gates, the road is directly in front of us, and there is a field also in front of us, and we're looking across those fields, and in the distance on the rising ground we can see the village of Messines and the very distinct spire of Messines Church. And Messines, the ridge, was captured by the Germans in the First Battle of Ypres, and Messines on Christmas Day that year was in German hands. It was an area where Adolf Hitler was, for example, at that time. But to our right, in the modern world, is a Christmas truce area, as it's often referred to, which includes a football memorial and some reconstructed trenches and an original bunker that was saved from a different location. The bunker is the only original part of this. I'm not a fan of the football memorial. We're going to talk a little bit more about football later on. It's a bogus memorial in many respects because it does not give us really the true story of Christmas Day 1914. And the trenches are constructed in completely the wrong way, in that they do not perpetuate the line as it was at that time. But they do, I suppose, give us a representation of some of those early trenches. And I guess, to a degree, local tourism feels that adds something to this site, whereas perhaps many of us might feel differently. But let's forget modern reconstructions and modern monuments and concentrate on what actually happened here in 1914. And if we look back to that field, and I'll put a map that Bairnsfather drew for this. Bruce Bairnsfather was an officer in the 1st Battalion, the Royal Warwickshire Regiment, and he joined them as a reinforcement after the Battle of Le Cateau. The 1st Warwicks were in a terrible state after the Battle of Le Cateau, and Bairnsfather, with several others, were those who arrived as replacements, as reinforcements, to make good those losses. Bairnsfather's stint in the trenches here at Plug Street was mixed with time behind the lines at the village of Wolvergum, which we mentioned in a previous podcast when we walked that area of the Flanders battlefield. And you can have a look at that episode if you go down the track list on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Bairnsfather was an artist, and when he was out of the line at Wolvergum, he would make drawings on the whitewashed walls of some of the farm outbuildings there, and he then began to scribble these down, and eventually they were published as the old Bill cartoons in the Bystander during that winter of 1914-15, and he became really a household name with his old Bill cartoons during the First World War, not quite so well known, sadly, over a century later. And there's a very good Bairnsfather account on Twitter that I would recommend you have a look at. But Bairnsfather published a book in 1916, Bullets and Billets, in which he describes his experiences in the 1914 campaign and during the Second Battle of Ypres, where he was wounded in 1915. It's a book published under the constrictions and the constraints of the propaganda and, in many respects, the language of the day. But it gives us a bit of an insight into some aspects of that period of the war. And Bairnsfather's battalion, the 1st Royal Warwicks, took part in a Christmas truce here on Christmas Day 1914, and he gives us a good account of it. Most parts of the British front where these truces took place, so going back to those early hours of Christmas Day and the thoughts of carols in the German trenches on Christmas Eve, what many British soldiers saw the next day were individuals or small parties of Germans coming up out of their trenches to try and instigate some form of truce on Christmas Day. Now, in the 1914 campaign, The Germans had carried out quite a few examples of what you could politely call ruse de guerre, tricks of war, and many soldiers, British soldiers, felt that this was not playing cricket. And as a consequence of this, whether these were real examples or all part of that propaganda, British soldiers mistrusted the Germans, and when they saw these parties of Germans coming forward on Christmas Day 1914, that mistrust was probably at the forefront of their minds. So the truce didn't initially happen quite as quickly as we often think. But as it became apparent that the Germans were wanting to have effectively a ceasefire, in some cases to fraternise, in some cases again to bury the dead on these areas where there had been fighting in December of 1914, both sides came out into no man's land. And it took a lot of trust, really, to do that. And going back to the idea that these men were professional soldiers, that this was their job, and I think that for some on the British side, that was an instigation behind it. This was a way of having a day off without the higher-ups knowing anything about it, that they'd get away with it. That's what they hoped. And so both sides come out into no man's land, and the fraternisation begins. And what we've got here at this point near Prowse Point Cemetery is a good example, a good account of it from Bullets and Billets by Bairnsfather. And we'll have a little bit of that account now. I clambered up and over our parapet and moved out across the field to look. Clad in a muddy suit of khaki and wearing a sheepskin coat and balaclava helmet, I joined the throng about halfway across to the German trenches. It all felt most curious. Here were these sausage-eating wretches who had elected to start this infernal European fracas, and in doing so had brought us all into the same muddy pickle as themselves. This was my first real sight of them at close quarters. Here they were, the actual practical soldiers of the German army. There was not an atom of hate on either side that day, and yet on our side, not for a moment, was the will to war and the will to beat them relaxed. It was just like the interval between the rounds in a friendly boxing match. The difference in type between our men and theirs was very marked. There was no contrasting the spirit of the two parties. Our men in their scratch costumes of dirty, muddy khaki, with the various assorted headdresses of woollen helmets, mufflers, and battered hats, were a light-hearted, open, humorous collection, as opposed to the sombre demeanour and stolid appearance of the Huns in their grey-green faded uniforms, top boots, and pork-pie hats. The shortest effect I can give of the impression I had was that our men, superior, broad-minded, more frank, and lovable beings, were regarding these faded, unimaginative products of perverted culture as a set of objectionable but amusing lunatics whose heads had got to be eventually smacked. "Look at that one over there, Bill," Albert would say, as he pointed out some particularly curious member of the party. I strolled about amongst them all and sucked in as many impressions as I could. Two or three of the Boches seemed to be particularly interested in me, and after they had walked around me once or twice with sullen curiosity stamped on their faces, one came up and said, "Offizier?" I nodded my head, which means yes in most languages, and besides, I can't talk German. These devils, I could see, all wanted to be friendly, but none of them possessed the open, frank geniality of our men. However, everyone was talking and laughing and souvenir hunting. I spotted a German officer, some sort of lieutenant, I should think, and being a bit of a collector, I intimated to him that I had taken a fancy to some of his buttons. We both then said things to each other which neither understood, and agreed to do a swap. I brought out my wire clippers, and with a few deft snips, removed a couple of his buttons and put them in my pocket. I then gave him two of mine in exchange. Suddenly, one of the Boches ran back to his trench, and presently reappeared with a large camera. I posed in a mixed group for several photographs, and have ever since wished I'd fixed up some arrangement for getting a copy. No doubt framed editions of this photograph are reposing on some Hun mantelpieces, showing clearly and unmistakingly to admiring strafers how a group of perfidious English surrendered unconditionally on Christmas Day to the brave Deutschers. Slowly the meeting began to disperse, a sort of feeling that the authorities on both sides were not very enthusiastic about this fraternising seemed to creep across the gathering. We parted, but there was a distinct and friendly understanding that Christmas Day would be left to finish in tranquillity. The last I saw of this little affair was a vision of one of my machine gunners, who was a bit of an amateur hairdresser in civil life, cutting the unnaturally long hair of a docile Boche who was patiently kneeling on the ground whilst the automatic clippers crept up the back of his neck. Now, that account of Bruce Bairn's father is, as you can see, dressed up in the language of the day, with phrases like Bosch and the Hun. But it does give us an insight into, typically, what happened in No Man's Land on Christmas Day. There was fraternisation. Men stood there, not really knowing what to say to each other. Few may well have spoken German, and some of the Germans may well have spoken English. But a lot of it was done by sign language and the exchange of souvenirs, whether that was buttons, shoulder titles, cloth insignia in the case of the Germans, cap badges, food and drink and anything else besides. And cameras were not prohibited as such at that stage of the war, and quite a lot of men in the British Expeditionary Force had brought cameras with them. So on different parts of the front on Christmas Day 1914, photographs were taken in No Man's Land illustrating the truce. And on the German side, cameras were far more prolific. They were far more commonplace. And no doubt there are many German illustrations, German images of the truce as well, just as Bairn's father hints at. We'll walk down the road now, away from Prowse Point Cemetery, down towards a bend in the road that takes us into the hamlet of Saint-Yvonne, St. Eve, as it's often referred to on some of the original maps of the time. And there's a little wooden cross just on the embankment on the left-hand side here that commemorates something that Taff Gillingham, who we had as a guest on the old front line, did well over a quarter of a century ago now, when he came here with some men from the Khaki Chums, and they dug a trench in this field and they lived as soldiers had done in that winter of 1914. Now, this cross, this wooden cross, this simple cross, was here for many years, and it gradually got almost covered at one stage in modern footballs, because this idea that football matches had taken place here was so commonplace. But there was no instance of football in this field on Christmas Day, or even a kick around. Bairn's father, in that book, in that account, does not mention it. Later on in the 50s, he was interviewed and seemed to change his story somehow, intimating that there had been some game of football here, but there is absolutely no evidence, and in the letters and diaries of other men from this area that survive, no mention of football. We will return to the subject of football later on in the podcast. But this little bend here, it really had, and the layouts of Saint-Yvonne, it really hasn't changed since 1914. And if you look at Bairn's father's map that I'll put on the podcast, you can see the layout of this ground is pretty much identical to where he was. And he mentions what he looked like on Christmas Day, his trench garb, his uniform and equipment that he was wearing. And he had a photograph taken in No Man's Land by one of his own men, which he used in Bullets and Billets. And again, I'll put that on the podcast website as well. We'll carry on along through the village of Saint-Yvonne. As the road bends again, there's a cottage on the corner, and there's a plaque there to Bairn's father, because this, as I mentioned before, was one of the areas where he began his old Bill cartoons. And Major Mrs. Holtz, who wrote some of the best, sort of almost definitive accounts of the work that Bairn's father did and the associated souvenirs, whether that was books or crested china that was produced reaction to just how popular these cartoons were. They had a plaque placed here back in the 80s, 90s, commemorating Bairn's father being in this sector. We'll walk past that and continue to the next T-junction. We're in almost a bit of a sunken lane here now, and we've crossed out into the area where the front line weaved through here on the eastern side of Plug Street Wood. We'll turn right. We'll walk down along that eastern edge of the woods to the next road junction, and we're right in the heart of the German position known as the Birdcage, which is where the Somersets had made their attack in December of 1914. And this area was a bit of the battlefield where there was quite a lot of dead lying out in No Man's Land. And then we'll continue round the next bend to where the road runs close to the edge of the wood to some dispersed little farm buildings, and we'll stop just before the next hamlet, the hamlet of Legia. And that'll be our next Christmas truce story. The village of Legia ahead of us sits on a road junction, with the main road coming from the village of Plug Street, through Legia towards the lower parts of the Messines Ridge, just beyond Plug Street Wood, and then intersected by the minor road that we're on now, coming down from St Yvonne and cutting through the village to the southern side towards the French border. It was captured in the fighting of October 1914, when the 1st Somersets and the 2nd Battalion, the Essex Regiment, fought here and took this ground in the more mobile fighting of that period of the war. And then both sides dug in, and the British positions were standing on this road looking towards Legia. The British positions were out in the field on the left, just beyond some of these farm buildings. Now, the unit that was here in the line on Christmas Day 1914 was the 1st 5th Battalion of the London Regiment, the London Rifle Brigade. They were a territorial battalion recruited before the war. It was very much a middle-class battalion. These were men from some of the trades and industries within the central part of London, men who lived in the commuter belts of London and commuted up into the city to do their work. There were men from some of the ordinary working class districts of London as well, but it was a battalion that before the war had made a decision that one of the conditions of joining was that you had to sign the Imperial Service Obligation, and therefore release yourself for overseas service in case of a future conflict. And that's why the 5th Londons became one of a number of London Regiment battalions to be sent over so quickly in the early phase of the Great War. They had not taken part in any of the fighting since their arrival on the Western Front in November of 1914, but they had been in the trenches alongside some of the regular battalions and got used to frontline service. They'd suffered casualties from snipers, from minenwerfers, from German trench mortars and rifle grenades, and some bombardments. Most of their casualties were from sickness caused in the conditions. Being a middle-class battalion, men who lived in those commuter belts of London, it was a tough generation in 1914, but you were asking men to live in open ditches, in fields, in often sub-zero conditions, and it was very, very difficult for these men, and some men suffered as a consequence of this, and there were casualties caused by the elements rather than the enemy. There are quite a few accounts of the London Rifle Brigade Christmas truce here, because being that middle-class battalion, men kept diaries, wrote letters home. So we've got those. There were some survivors of the 5th Londons who were later interviewed for the Great War series or for Malcolm Brown's excellent documentary in the 1980s, which is on YouTube, and I'll put a link to that on the website, Peace in No Man's Land. Some of them are interviewed on there. But one of the better known accounts of the London Rifle Brigade involvement in the truce comes from the author Henry Williamson. Williamson became a nature writer after the war and is best known for his nature books, Tarka the Otter and Salar the Salmon. And Williamson was obsessed by the war, obsessed by his service in it, and wrote probably millions of words connected to that service, whether in fiction or in direct autobiographical accounts of it. In the 1930s, he was a very, very popular radio broadcaster and a great orator. But Williamson, like a lot of veterans at that time, turned to politics, and his politics took him down a dark path with involvement of the British Union of Fascists, which involved in the Second World War him being detained and arrested under security regulations in 1940. When I was an undergraduate, I did quite a lot of research for my last year dissertation on the involvement of ex-servicemen in the British Union of Fascists, and Williamson wasn't uncommon in the misheld belief that because Adolf Hitler was a veteran of the Great War, a veteran of the trenches, that his predominant view would be to never have another war again, and that's what drove people like Williamson. And he saw Mosley's connection to Hitler and the fascists as a way to avoid a future war. Williamson was wrong in that, and the dark side of Nazi Germany that few really realised in the 1930s didn't become apparent until much later on. This is not an excuse, Williamson's beliefs. They were abhorrent and they were wrong. And he paid a price for that in that he was never really officially recognised as the writer that he was. But it's important, I think, to understand the context of this. And Williamson wasn't alone in these beliefs. But his writing and his accounts of this period are incredibly powerful and important in our understanding of the Great War. And this account, which I'm very pleased to have been given a copy of by the Williamson family some years ago, is a recording that was made of him talking about the Christmas truce in the 1960s.
On Christmas Eve, we had a job to do in No Man's Land, which put the wind up everybody. That is to say, we were all quiet among ourselves. The job was to go into frozen No Man's Land and drive in some stakes which were to support hurdles on which some tobacco had been drying in a barn in the woods. Of course, it was all abandoned by the Belgians. And we were to make a sort of alleyway or cover from view so that in the event of a German attack, we could reoccupy the Hampshire Tea Trench, which had been abandoned owing to the floods in it, because that was a key position. Now, it was explained to us that we had to knock in these posts 18 inches into this frozen soil, and we'd be 50 yards away from the Germans. And then about 11 o'clock, I saw a Christmas tree going up on the German trenches, and there was a light. And we stood still, and we watched this, and we talked. And then a German voice began to sing a song, Heilige Nacht. And after that, somebody, come over, Tommy, come over. And they still thought it was a trap. But some of us went over at once, and they came to this barbed wire fence between us, which was five strands of wire, hung with empty bully beef tins to make a rattle if they came. And very soon we were exchanging gifts. The next day we went out again. The whole of No Man's Land, as far as we could see, was grey and khaki. There they were, smoking and talking, shaking hands, exchanging names and addresses for after the war to write to one another. We had, at that time, because the Germans started burying their dead, which were frozen out, and we picked up ours and buried them. And little crosses of ration box wood were nailed together, quite small ones, and indelible pencil, they would put, the Germans, Für Vaterland und Freiheit. For Fatherland and Freedom. And I said to a German, excuse me, but how can you be fighting for freedom? You started the war, and we are fighting for freedom. And he said, excuse me, English comrade, but we are fighting for freedom, for our country. And I say, you also put, here rests in God an unbekannter, held. Here rests in God an unknown hero, in God. Oh, yes. God is on our side. But I said, he's on our side. And that was a tremendous shock. One began to think that these chaps, who were like ourselves, whom we liked, and who felt about the wars we did, and who said, it'll be over soon because we will win the war in Russia. And we said, no, but the Russian steamroller is going to win the war in Russia. Well, English comrade, do not let us quarrel on Christmas Day.
The point that Williamson makes there is a good one, because this was the first time that most British soldiers had encountered the enemy face to face. For many of them, the first time that they'd ever spoken to a German. But Williamson was a little bit different to most of his comrades in that he had German ancestry. He spoke German, and his father had named their house at Eastern Road in Ladywell in southeast London Hildesheim, a sign that was on their gate, which his father had quickly removed on the outbreak of war in 1914. And Williamson, I think, had a lifelong sympathy with the Germans and felt, like many great war veterans, a kinship to the men on the other side of the battlefield, on the other side of no man's land, that he'd served with. But for him, this was a dark day in his life. It was a day that, when you listen to that account, he sounds quite joyful about it. But having taken members of Williamson's family, including some of his sons, to the spots on the battlefield where he'd fought and that he wrote about, they recounted how that for them, Christmas Day as children should have been a day of joy, a day of wonder, but was a dark day because their father went into this terrible, terrible depression, thinking back to Christmas Day in 1914 and this meeting of both forces in no man's land. Only, if only, the war could have been stopped, considering the spirit that was abound that day. That's how Williamson felt. But it would never have happened, of course. We know that now. This was a day off for these men. And Williamson, I think it was bound up in his deep, deep belief that the war was this tragic episode in European, in world history, and that for him, it should never, ever happen again. So we'll leave the London Rifle Brigade, where, again, another part of the line where there's no recorded football matches, continue through the village of Legia, follow the road down to the next village of Frelingham to look at the next part of the truce involving the 2nd Battalion, the Essex Regiment and the Monmouthshire Regiment. This part of the battlefield, close to the hamlet of Latouke and the village of Frelinghine, is on the southern part of the Ypres battlefields, close to the French border. The River Lys runs close to here, and that marks the border in this particular spot. And the truce that took place here is of particular interest to me because my great uncle, Dan Boyles, Uncle Dan as I called him, was one who was here with the 2nd Battalion, the Essex Regiment. They had been in the line here before Christmas, and there had actually been a pre-Christmas truce here on the 10th of December 1914, when Germans had come out into no man's land and some men from the 2nd Essex had gone out to meet them too. A couple of weeks later, by Christmas, the battalion, the 2nd Essex, were actually out of the line, and it was the 2nd Battalion of the Monmouthshire Regiment that were actually holding the frontline positions here on Christmas Day. Their war diary records, and I quote, "On Christmas Day, practically nothing took place on either side." Now, when I read that, it sounds like Baldric in Blackadder being asked to explain the presence of a dead pigeon on a plate. So, was that the official view that they put in their diary so that the truth of the matter didn't emerge? Because here on Christmas Day, there was a truce between the Monmouths and the Germans on the other side of No Man's Land, with a large number of men from each unit participating in it. But it was a truce that had gone wrong that day, because two men from the battalion ended up getting killed. One was killed by a stray shot while he was burying the dead, and another was killed taking woodbines to the Germans. So when we think of the truce, and it took place on a large proportion of the British line that day, it wasn't always universal, and there were a number of men who were killed. And these two lads from the Monmouths who died that day are buried in the nearby Calvary Essex Military Cemetery. The Monmouths were relieved that evening by the 2nd Battalion of the Essex Regiment, and my Uncle Dan was amongst the men from the battalion who took over the trenches. There is some evidence that the truce here continued despite the arrival of a new battalion, and many areas of the Christmas truce, one of the reasons they came to an end, in some cases they lasted a day or several days, in others a bit longer than that, they usually came to an end because one unit or another was relieved, either the British unit or the German unit, and the next one coming in didn't really understand what this truce was all about, or the officers who commanded that battalion, that unit, didn't want to participate in it. The 2nd Essex diary just says that the next day, Boxing Day, was a quiet day. So there's nothing in their diary about any truce, but there are some surviving letters from men in the Essex Regiment describing a Christmas period truce. So it could be that there was some fraternisation following the episodes of the Monmouths there on Christmas Day itself. What I think this shows us is the complexity, really, of the story of the Christmas truce, in that it's often hard to verify what actually happened from some of the surviving contemporary documents. Unless we have eyewitness accounts of a truce, it can just slip from the pages of history. And that it wasn't just a case of these men coming out, shaking hands, swapping souvenirs and trying each other's food and drink, and it carrying on and on and on. It lasted for short periods, it lasted for long periods. Units came and went. Units came and went on the other side of no man's land. Not every British unit wanted to participate, and not every German unit wanted to participate. So the truce is a myriad of stories, just like the Great War is a myriad of faces and backgrounds and histories. And it's some of those aspects of the truce that we'll look at next. So what was the reaction to the Christmas truce at the time? Well, amongst some senior officers, there was anger and outrage and annoyance that had taken place. They were fighting an enemy, not fraternising with them. And amongst some of them, there was talk of court-martial, although that never transpired. For others, they had no particular issue with it. Walter Congreve, VC, who'd been awarded the Victoria Cross for his bravery in the Boer War, and his son would be awarded a posthumous Victoria Cross on the Somme in 1916, he came up and it's recorded that he liked hearing the carols that were being sung. So no one was punished for this, and there were no repercussions amongst any of the units that were present during the truce itself. I suspect, given the vague approach to recording it in war diaries and the omittance in most cases of it, meant that very few senior officers above brigade and divisional level were even aware that it had happened. So nothing was really done. However, what's interesting is that news must have eventually permeated its way down the line, because a year later, on Christmas Day 1915, and we've got this indicated, for example, in an operations order from the 47th London Division Headquarters diary, is that there was instructions to bombard No Man's Land on Christmas Day 1915 to prevent another truce from taking place. Now, that didn't happen on every part of the line a year later, but it's an interesting insight into how some senior officers prevented a truce from happening again. It was reported eventually in newspapers, both national ones and regional ones. There was a lot less restriction on the reporting of events in France, and newspapers, particularly local newspapers, could print pretty much verbatim letters from men at the front with full details of their unit without any restrictions. That changed later on in the war. And photographs taken by some of the men who were there that had the cameras did appear in the newspapers as well. So it was something that was known while the war was on. Post-war, no book was ever written about the truce in the immediate period following the First World War, which is surprising and perhaps, you know, gives us a bit of an indication as to the contemporary view of its importance, given the global, the wider picture of the Great War. And of course, we can't finish this podcast about the Christmas truce without discussing what I've hinted at a few times, and that's the subject of football. There is probably a widespread belief, with monuments, with contemporary culture and media, videos from the 1980s, Pipes of Peace by Paul McCartney, before that the film Oh What a Lovely War, there's references in Blackadder to the whole idea of these Christmas Day football matches. And I'm sure many people do believe this. And we've seen doctored images out of context being used to prove this, monuments being placed on the battlefields to this. So what is the truth of the Christmas Day football match? Well, I'm sorry, dear listeners, if you were expecting to hear anything different, but the reality is there was no Christmas Day football match as depicted in recent and even past media, culture, newspapers, television, whatever. I'm afraid it didn't happen quite as we might have believed that it happened. There was some examples of what you could describe as a kick around, and one of those that we know of for sure took place at Wolvergum beneath the Messines Ridge on Christmas Day 1914, involving the men of the 1st 6 Cheshires, also some men from the 1st Norfolks who were close by. This, through the excellent work of Taff Gillingham, who was on the podcast a few months ago, resulted in the Sainsbury's advert that we remember from 2014. But this is probably the best known and best documented example of such a kick around. There is a couple of others, but there's no big match. There's no England versus Germany. There's no precursor to 1966. That's the stuff of mythology. And when you think about it, think about what No Man's Land was at that time and the problems of having a football match under those conditions. It was a battlefield. It wasn't a flat bit of ground. It was smashed up by artillery fire, by trench mortars. There was barbed wire. Williamson spoke about the old tobacco drying stakes that were out in No Man's Land. There were features like that that had once been part of civilian life in this area that would have blocked the ability to play any game of football. And there were bodies everywhere. So this was not ground on which you could easily kick a ball around. And that was not really, I think, on the minds of most men who were out there. There was the shock of suddenly being in the positions between the trenches without being fired at. The shock of seeing what was your enemy. The shock of that enemy talking back to you. And then the breaking down of some barriers as you swapped your souvenirs and your food and your drink. And, you know, I'm sure there were some men and it entered their mind to have a game of football, but the footballs were not in the frontline trench. They were not carried in the knapsacks of the men that were there. There wasn't an opportunity to do this. And perhaps football in 1914 was not as important to that generation as it is to people now. It was a growing sport, but it wasn't possibly a national sport in the way it is over a century after the Great War. So this is a modern obsession, really, a modern obsession that twists the story at Christmas Day 1914 and obscures what I think are the most important aspects behind it. So the next question to ask is, did it happen again? Well, no, not on this scale. In some cases, there wasn't a Christmas truce in sectors, but there was a New Year truce. And the truce itself was limited, really, to the British front. There are very few examples on the French sector of such a truce. Although down at La Boisselle on the Somme, a French padre stepped forward and arranged with the Germans to have a truce that was not necessarily about Christian spirit, but a bit like on some parts of the British sector, it was about burying the dead because there'd been a French attack involving the men from Breton in an assault on the German lines there in December 1914, and like on the British sector, there were bodies in No Man's Land that really needed to be buried. So there were some examples of that. But in terms of in the British sector, did it happen again? Then, as mentioned previously, in some areas, there were bombardments a year later that prevented it. I've come across, when we were making a television programme about Messines in 2012, that the 16th Battalion Canadian Infantry, the Canadian Scottish, attempted a truce with the Germans at Messines on Christmas Day 1915, but that didn't really happen and the Germans were not massively keen on it. And when you think about it, you know, a year on from Christmas 1914, the war was in its infancy then, and there was a year of terrible casualties and some pretty horrendous battles that the British Army fought on the Western Front. And when you look at attacks like Neuve Chapelle and Albers Ridge and Festubert and the Battle of Loos, a year on, I don't think anyone really had the stomach for a Christmas truce in 1915. The war had changed, the army had changed, the original pre-war regulars, the professionals, had largely gone. It was new army men, territorials, and then a year on from that, at the end of the Battle of the Somme in 1916, the army was increasingly becoming a conscript army. The conditions on the battlefield in the winter of 1916-17 with minus 25 on the Somme front prevented such a truce, even if it was wanted. A year on again, 1917, the war was now a total war, an industrial war on a massive scale. But in that winter of 1917-18, there is a recorded truce on a very small scale on the front of the Royal Naval Division on Welsh Ridge at Lavacary on the Cambrai battlefields. But then a year on from that, the war was over. La Guerre Finie and the truce, the history of the truce, the events of that day in Christmas 1914 passed into memory. It had been unique, though, unique to that first Christmas of the war, in its scale and its involvement of men from both sides, which makes us ask, what is the importance of the Christmas truce? Well, it wasn't football, because that was such a very, very minor part of it, with the few kick-arounds that there were. Essentially, the real story of the Christmas truce is about these ordinary men from both sides instigating this ceasefire on the battlefield, stepping out into that dangerous ground between their trenches, mixing with the enemy, talking to the enemy, swapping things with the enemy, humanising the enemy. Hard thing for soldiers to fight and successfully conclude a war. To a degree, you have to dehumanise your enemy to fight them, to kill them, and to win. But on that day, there was a bit of humanity. And like Williamson, I think, though, that event changed many men that were there. One of the veterans, in one of his accounts, says, and he uses a very strange turn of phrase for us now, but an interesting one nevertheless, that the truce involved them ignoring the dictates of imperial systems. Because in some respects, the truce was a revolt against all the things that they've been conditioned to do, and certainly in the early period of the war, been conditioned to think by the propaganda. It was a moment in time, a bit of humanity, the old world fading away in some respects. Williamson, you remember, referred to the previous Christmas as the last Christmas of the old world. Perhaps this was its last embers, the last glow of those embers, as that old world faded and the new hard world of industrial killing, of warfare on a global scale, became parts of humanity's story. But it was that small piece of humanity in a long war, and something that none of them who were there would ever forget. And as the truce faded away and the men returned to their trenches and now looked out into no man's lands through once more their box periscopes, they thought of that day when they'd been between the trenches in no man's land with those on the other side of the wire, and they wondered when they'd see them again. Old Fritz, old Jerry, what lay ahead for them all, what lay ahead along the old front line. Well, this episode of The Old Front Line brings season one of the podcast to an end. It's been an incredible journey with you all since March. It's been an extraordinary year in so many different respects. And I'd planned to do some form of podcast last year, but as always, things got in the way. And I thought to myself, when will I have the time to sit down and do this? And then, of course, this year comes along. I'd like to thank you all for your support, both on Twitter with all your comments and retweets and likes, for those of you who have left reviews and star ratings on Apple Podcasts, for those of you comments on the podcast website. It's always good to get your feedback, and many of you have emailed in, and you can do that by sending an email to oldfrontlinepodcast@gmail.com, for example. And recently, as we've moved through the podcast and it's grown in many respects, I'd really like to take this opportunity to thank you sincerely to those of you who have taken the time and the effort to support the production of the podcast via Patreon and also via Buy Me a Coffee. I'm really quite overwhelmed with those of you that have done this, and it's enabled me to buy some new equipment to record in the field when we can all get back to visiting the old front line again, and with a few ideas in the pipeline for next year, for season two of this podcast and beyond. It will help with that as well. So a big thank you. But all of you support the podcast one way or another by telling your friends, by mentioning it on social media, by putting a link in on your Facebook page, and by listening. And there are now thousands of you listening to every episode. And I'm so grateful to you for doing that. And I think more than that, for me, it just shows the interest in the Great War is not fading away, that it is at a constant, if not growing, and that the stories that connect us to the old front line are just as important as they ever were. So this is the end of season one. Season two will return in the new year, in January, just after Christmas. I'll put announcements to the exact date on social media in due course. And with the subjects of the Christmas truce in our minds and Christmas drawing near, a very different Christmas for many of us, I just want to wish you a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. And here's to the time that we can all once more walk along the lanes and past those beacons of the Great War on the old front line. Thank you. You've been listening to an episode of The Old Front Line with me, military historian Paul Reed. You can follow me on Twitter at SomCor. You can follow the podcast at Old Front Line Pod. Check out the website at oldfrontline.co.uk, where you'll find lots of podcast extras and photographs and links to books that are mentioned in the podcast. And if you feel like supporting us, you can go to our Patreon page, patreon.com/oldfrontline, or support us on Buy Me a Coffee at buymeacoffee.com/oldfrontline. Links to all of these are on our website. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you again soon.